This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
What a day, what a week.
Yes, a very shocking disclosure, which I suppose puts the events of the last few weeks in a very different perspective.
Yes, of course. And I think we have to be honest, if we'd known about the cancer, we would probably not have talked to Valentine in the way we did a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And a lot of things wouldn't have been published unsaid around the world to fill that kind of vacuum that was left. But anyway.
We're talking about the shocking announcement that the Princess of Wales has cancer when it's being treated.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, you know, everyone in the press was speculating, maybe Valentine just had a very good instinct, or perhaps he knew more than he was able to say. But
sure. For those who haven't heard it, I mean, Valentine was actually very good and very calm, and you know, he's particularly well informed, being the former royal correspondent from the Times. But it does make me feel a little bit regretful, I guess, now knowing what I now know. And I'm probably not the only person who feels that way in our world.
Well, I think everyone in the media, you know, we were. It was a big story. It was a story we felt we had to address. A lot of people had asked us about it. We brought in a serious commentator. And I think, you know, we were raising some of the things that had been raised with us and elsewhere in the media for him to shoot down or to respond to, which he did. So, you know, though, as you say, in retrospect, perhaps we would never have done that program if the situation had been different. We are where we are.
Sure.
I just wish the royal family had perhaps tried to kill this story much earlier than they did very effectively with her announcement.
One thing it shows is the incredible global impact still of everything that they do. I mean, there are people all over the world reacting to this, and I'm completely obsessed with the story now. You know, we just
last week. Major figure. If you think, you know, we do a lot of pieces on the monarchy. There are, you know, two crucial figures, I think, I would call the Fab Four, which is the King and Queen and the Prince and Princess of Wales. And two of them are out of action at the moment. It's putting a lot of pressure on the other two, who, after all, are having to be concerned about ill partners. Mm. And in some ways, it's spreading the load, hopefully, to others, like the Duke of Duchess of Edinburgh and the Princess Royal. But it's raised the questions of whether we do want a slimmed down monarchy. I don't know if you've got views. I mean, my own view is that we expect too much of them. And we just, you know, there are only a certain number to go around. I don't think we should have more of them, but I think we should be less demanding of them.
Well, we've got used to it. I mean, every organization above a certain number of members seems to feel it has to have a royal patron and that they need that for visibility and to attract attention and money to throw events and parties. That would change a lot if suddenly there were just three or four people and that's it. That would it would transform the charity sector, certainly in Britain.
People complain, you know, that they're being knighted by Princess Anne rather than by the king. I mean, there is a sort of pecking order, but I suppose even the minor royals still are better than nothing. But maybe, you know, this is too much to place on a particular family. I mean, the younger generation have their careers, they have their families. You know, why should they all go into the family firm? I mean, it's a story. It's, you know, you could say it's a story of succession or any family firm.
Yes.
Which don't tend to last generations. They tend to last three generations.
There's been quite a high wastage rate in terms of both internal disputes, like with Harry and Meghan and them leaving. And then, of course, Andrew. This Andrew's got a really good piece, which is due to run in the Daily Mail about his continuing work on Prince Andrew, which I'd recommend to you if you're listening or watching. Shall we move on?
Yes, we should move on. And also, I recommend a Channel 5 documentary on the Windsors and the Bahamas that went out last night, Saturday.
Are you in it?
Yes, I was consultant. Indeed, my daughter was the researcher.
Oh, excellent.
So it was a family business there, like the monarchy.
Family business of scandal mongering. We've had some lovely emails. Our friend David Wilson wrote from the pool in Malaysia, listening to the Suez program a few weeks ago, saying how much he enjoyed it, although reminding us that talk about the wind of change in the empire. Actually, quite a few things had already moved before Suez. In places like Malaya and Kenya, there was quite a lot of change, which I thought was an interesting point. Very interesting comment, I thought, on our program about Agatha Christie from somebody who, Escarpment24, don't know who this person is, but he enjoyed the show very much. It really is worth checking out, actually. We love Laura Thompson. And he points out that The Mousetrap, the famous play by Agatha Christie, was based on the true story of his own uncle and his brother, who had been abused by the couple who fostered them, and then one of them had died as a result. As we did talk about,
her stories were
very dark. Well, that's one of them. That's the background.
Yeah, gosh.
Andrew. We're popping up in all kinds of unusual places, again, on the chart. Would. Greece, Kuwait, Finland. So people are finding us still.
Good. And they're going back to old podcasts, really, rather than just the new ones.
Yes, no, they are. No, we had, like, I think it was about 13,000 again this week. And only about three of those maybe would have been for the new shows.
No, that's so good.
Thank you for all the people that are exploring the back catalogue.
Yes, thank you. Yes, no, we really need to build our subscribers. We're still sort of debating whether to do two programmes a week, which is quite demanding, given we both are writing books at the moment and I have a full-time job, and whether people are happy just with...
shambles here of notes and nonsense.
Right. Well, you've got your deadline. At least I haven't got a deadline in the same way. But we're wondering if once a week is better, that you or if you really can't do without us. Every 3 days.
Yes. Well, we've got a few more for the next couple of weeks, and then we might take a view about going back to one a week. But today it's a special treat for you because we're going to be talking to one of your heroes.
Indeed, yes. Richard Norton Taylor is a long-standing champion of freedom of information. He's had a long career as the Whitehall correspondent of The Guardian, having worked for Newsweek and various other papers before that. I think it's a career going back over 50 years. And he's been a doughty fighter for a whole series of questions, not just about official secrecy, but anything really to deal with secrecy in government. And I think we're going to cover a couple of the stories. I think we're perhaps going to keep Lockerbie back because he did a lot of work on that for a future program. But otherwise,
I think he's going to talk to us about the Iraq War.
Yeah.
Julian Assange.
Yeah.
And the rights and wrongs of that case. Yeah. And of course, Grenfell Tower.
Yes.
He's been a terrible tragedy in Britain of a few years ago, which he's done a lot of work on.
And very interesting because he's also a playwright and he's used his plays to get public interest and indeed official interest in some of the stories. And that's quite an interesting angle. I think he's unique there.
Excellent.
So I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay, well, here we go. Some good public interest investigative journalism coming your way right now. Here we go.
Well, I'm delighted today to have somebody I have a great deal of respect for, the investigative journalist Richard Norton Taylor. who's been looking into Whitehall and intelligence services since 1975, having previously served as a correspondent in Brussels. Richard, just to begin, I mean, what are the most important campaigns do you think that you fought over the years?
Well, I think the campaign against uniquely British official secrecy, I think, probably. And I benefited a lot because I started journalism as a sort of green journalist in Brussels, where Britain was about to join what we then call the Common Market or European Community, a better word than European Union, I think. Anyhow, and I saw Britain not at the centre of the universe, like so many British journalists do and still do, indeed. Westminster is the centre of the universe. But Britain, as an equal member of then a nine-member community, now well over 20, but and so the kind of exceptionalism, if you like, of the British, the particular brand of official secrecy did not work. And it was a wonderful playground for me as a journalist, a playground, at least in a responsible way, a wonderful place to be a receptacle, because other countries who before had sort of resented British secrecy and arrogance, like the Irish joined or the Danish, small countries, but also the Germans and French, used to use us, journalists, British journalists, to embarrass the British, really, because there are permanent negotiations about everything. Anyway, it also Brussels was, of course, a wonderful centre for spies, because it was where NATO is headquarters. The headquarters of NATO is Brussels, whereas the headquarters of the European Union. So it was a wonderful listening post, and for journalists like me. And to repeat the point, when I came back to Britain, I took a sort of more, I could take a more distant, sceptical view of what the British were saying, what the British establishment was saying, and, of course, the most secretive part of what Christopher Andrew, once the official historian of MI5, described as the last taboo of British politics, i.e. the spooks, the secret and intelligence services. So that is what encouraged me to pursue, when I came back to Britain from Brussels, the antics, activities of the security intelligence services and defence too, of course, in particular, although official secrecy in general.
And did it get easier or harder as you went on, do you think?
Did my work get harder? In some ways, yes, in some ways, no. Sorry about that boring answer. But because in some ways, yes, because as Britain got more and more secretive, certainly under conservative governments, but also easier because I got more and more confident, really. And one got to learn the sort of undergrowth of Whitehall, the permanent government, as some people call it, or I call it, actually. And that means the scene, the mandarins, if you like, of Whitehall. Undergrowth of Whitehall, there were a lot of people who are frustrated by their political masters and indeed in some ways of secrecy and their cover-ups, the political cover-ups. I'm not saying that the Whitehall Mandarin classes were in favour of greater openness particularly, but they did get frustrated by lots of decisions. And that came out particularly during the sort of Tony Blair's government, actually, and specifically the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where that's just an example where I relied on and got very good information, including from the MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Services, half of which were viciously against the invasion, as was MI5 under the, I think, rather wonderful Eliza Manning and Buller, who was the head of MI5. But, of course, they talked to me a lot, but they were always not for quoting, i.e. I had to say Western intelligence officials or British officials say X, Y, and Z, which was difficult in a way, but because there weren't sort of open whistleblowers. But you could make your point. Anyway, that encouraged me because I knew that in the undergrowth were a lot of frustrated officials who were very, let's say, opposed to the antics and the activities and indeed sometimes the policies of their political masters, i.e. ministers.
I wanted to talk to you about Iraq because it seemed to me, you talk about the secret state, but that was a time when maybe the secret state was powerless or wasn't able to get its own way. because the political pressure was, you know, notably drawing up those famous dossiers and the supposedly sexed up language that was used.
Yes.
Must have been an incredible time to be a journalist, actually. But frightening as well.
Well, the growing frustration in various degrees, sometimes senior mandarins in Whitehall, as I say, but also the even inside the security intelligence services, who, and that's very rewarding, really. And you get, it was more than a game; it was serious, professional, if you like, for journalism. And sometimes you couldn't believe that what people were telling you. And the only trouble was the impact was not as great as if you could name these people. I mean, just one person, going back to invasion of Iraq is an example. Again, only one person, a lawyer in the Foreign Office, resigned, and a woman who then became on the record. Yeah, she said things on the record. But it was because also you're encouraged to dig, if you like. I mean, and as time went on, you felt sort of... You felt all the things that all the lies, if you like, all the euphemisms and degrees of disingenuous, etc. That you were or half lies or unsaid lies and not direct lies, as they say in Whitehall. This wasn't a direct lie, Richard. Someone told me about the sinking of the Belgrano during the Falklands War. But anyway, you did get. More and more, you were getting encouraged because you knew that, after experience, that the frustration on various policies was building up. If I can add, even when the pressure increased, partly thanks to what I'd written, other people had written, partly what the European Convention on Human Rights demanded, i.e. putting MI5 and MI6 and GCHQ on a legal footing, which they finally did under John Major. Thatcher did on the phone tapping legislation, actually. And senior people in MI6 and MI5 said, yes, we want more openness, because otherwise you, i.e. me and other journalists, can make up all these stories about what we are up to, MI5 and MI6 and so on, and they can't answer back because they don't officially exist. So officials said, minister to Thatcher and others, look, it's better at least that we put on a legal footing so we can say this is right, this is wrong. We can have some kind of outfit monitoring the activities of the Security Intelligence Service, i.e. the Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committee, which I have to say was a typical British thing. You go one step or two steps forward and one and three quarter steps back, i.e. you have some kind of official committee independent of parliamentarians. But of course, you put so many loopholes around and restrictions on what they can do and what witnesses and what they can say and what witnesses they can hear. But anyway, so it was ministers who are sometimes more restrictive than even officials, who realized that they needed to be a bit more open for pragmatic.
Could I have one more question on Iraq? Because I know Andrew's got lots of things he wants to talk about, but I find this period fascinating. You had an amazing ringside view of it. And to you, I'm guessing it was like a slow motion car crash. I hold my hand up. I was one of the many people who kept faith with Blair. You know, I let's face it, Saddam Hussein, he'd used weapons of mass destruction. He'd hidden them from the UN. There was every reason to believe he still had them, except there was no real evidence he still had them. And we were going to go to war over this.
Yeah.
And of course, all the official, and this goes to your point about the secret state, once the disaster unfolded, there was inquiry after inquiry, and guess what? All the main players were acquitted.
Well, yes, MI5, they didn't speak loudly on the record at all, but for example, the security service, MI5, was concerned because it would encourage Islamist-based terrorism in Britain. It's a provocative act. You invade Iraq. And Ministry of Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, didn't like it because they were politicizing intelligence reports, i.e. the dodgy dossiers and so on. And that, above all, was the hand behind that of Alistair Campbell, Blair's top spin doctor. But other people, and I've said this and written this before, should have done much more, like the Joint Intelligence Committee there under John Scarlett, who had been a good spy master in Moscow and so on beforehand, but he went along far too much with the interference of intelligence gathering, supposed to be rigorously independent, Tony Blair's number 10. Yeah.
It's interesting. I think Scarlett could have probably stopped it, but he didn't. And he was Blair's get out of jail card in all those inquiries.
Yeah.
But isn't part of the problem that, I mean, the intelligence services, like the armed forces, were sort of politicized? You know, in order to get preferment, you basically had to be a yes man, or you were, and the people who were promoted basically supported their political masters. So we had no independent sort of scrutiny or people speaking truth to power.
That's right. Some did a little bit. For example, I think MI6 was divided in half, and some people would tell me things. And one example was I wrote a story saying that on your point, Andrew, that the British Foreign Intelligence MI6 were not criticizing the CIA, and the CIA was just even more accepting whatever Bush and his other people were saying, even though people in the CIA knew that things weren't what they suggested was happening in Iraq and Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program and all that stuff. So I wrote a story saying MI6 officials have told me, The Guardian, blah, 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 that they're very angry that the Foreign Office here is just accepting what America's CIA is saying all the time. And another point, really, is that after the invasion of Iraq, and it goes for more than just Iraq, it goes for, I think, everything, with someone very senior Whitehall official, very senior official involved in intelligence, and then another senior roles told me, I won't say who he is, told me, Richard, he said, over lunch at the Travelers Club, the great the Spooks Club, if you like, just think of it. No, just imagine any British Prime Minister to say no to an American president on such a vital issue as a military operation in Iraq. And it was a kind of, it wasn't a serious, he knew what the answer was. And that was meant to persuade me. He was sympathetic with more openness, but he's just making the point that politically, because on the point, especially, you know, intelligence sharing is the key, the real key to special relationship with America.
But your point is that secrecy really comes from the top. So it's the politicians who are covering up, that actually the intelligence services might be more open. Or is it
relatively speaking, yes.
But is it a wider problem? Is there a culture of secrecy, for example, in Whitehall? Is there too much deference by the press, by even the courts, to allow them to, in a sense, use national security to cover up things?
Yes, and you say even courts. Actually, courts are much more have been revealed in some court case taken by brave lawyers, but for example, how British citizens and residents were taken to Guantanamo Bay by the Americans, and these people took the matter to court, and because the courts demanded openness, demanded disclosure of documents, so a lot came out from MI5 and MI6 and the government. And alleged collusion in alleged torture and all that stuff, but it's the. Everyone wants a quiet life. I don't overdo the openness of the mandarins versus their political masters, ministers, but everyone's a quite quiet life, and so, you know, mandarins would say they want to deny everything as possible, all the weapons they use, euphemism, delaying tactics, etc., etc. Ministers also want a quiet life. They don't have to answer questions from members of parliament. And of course, so many members, very few backbenchers would want to pursue the activities or questions about the activities of security intelligence services. And there's a kind of, you know, they're indoctrinated. There's a kind of British clubby atmosphere. They said, come on, old boy, don't ask too many questions. It's very embarrassing. National security. National security is used, of course. National security covers a mountain of a multitude of sins. National security, you can't possibly talk about national security. And the whole official secrecy, that's another point, the official secrecy point, is honoured in the rule, is honoured in the breach as much as the observance, because ministers say to MPs, it's a well-known practice, as you know, that I can't, that the governments, successive governments have never revealed anything about intelligence matters. But of course, then they leak like mad. Let's take the special forces, for example, SAS, Special Forces, SBS, and the Naval Equipment, the SBS, are covered by more official secrecy, and war official secrecy, even than MI5, MI6, and GCHQ, which at least has some kind of parliamentary committee looking at them, albeit in private. SAS, you must be absolutely silent about SAS. Dangerous, people's lives at risk, blah, blah, blah. But what happens? Unofficially, of course, the Ministry of Defense leaks stories to their special trusted journalists to say what a wonderful victory this British Special Forces did that X, Y, and Z when operations go well. So there's a tremendous amount of humbug in all this.
But we have a situation at the moment with an inquiry into the SAS and their operations in Iraq,
yes,
which suggests that they were, for example, yes, shooting innocent people and covering it up.
Yes.
I mean,
well, that is interesting, because it's a few journalists pushing this very hard. I remember writing about it for a very, very long time, but BBC Panorama and the Sunday Times did more recently digging on this. And there comes a point, God knows how much argument, I'd love it to be a fly on the wall in the arguments in Whitehall saying, how do we stop this? Do we have an inquiry or not? And of course, they have had an inquiry, and it's going on now. And I think under quite a tough high appeal court judge.
We're getting a former government minister, Johnny Mercer, admitting that he was aware that this was going on and really didn't really do anything at the time about it.
Well, Johnny Mercer said, backed up the reports, you know, about what wrongdoing, what executions, if you like, and extrajudicial killing the SAS were alleged to have done, indeed evidence that they did do. And Johnny Mercer, the Veterans Minister, now gave evidence. But in his statement, I mean, he must have had a very bad lawyer writing, because in his court statement or inquiry statement, he said, people have told me, two or three, multiple people, i.e. former Special Forces officers, mates of his, told me that this was going on, these wrongful activities, execution of innocent people, unarmed people, and so on, in Afghanistan. And so they hadn't came and said, look, you've got to tell us who these people are, because you get that they will be protected. We need to name these people, your sources, and they'll be protected by immunity from prosecution, because we want to get to the truth, says Haddon Cave, the inquiry chairman. And he's threatening him with, because Mercer, very embarrassed, I think, didn't expect the inquiry chairman to push him on this. But he's just said rather loosely. I mean, if I were his lawyer, you can't say things in a statement like that without being warned by his lawyer. Say, look, you're going to be asked about this. Anyway, he's now threatened with them. It could be threatened with a jail, actually. Don't know what's going to happen in the end.
For people who don't know, and not everybody does, we're talking about Johnny Mercer, a former minister in the British Defence Ministry.
A current veteran minister for Defence Affairs, yeah.
Who clearly does know things about these allegations of war.
Yeah, because he knows. He was attached to the SAS in Afghanistan. Yeah.
That's right. And he's refusing to speak, and it's possible he might actually end up going to prison.
Yes.
Just for people who don't know.
That's right, because under the court, under the Inquiries Act, witnesses and potential witnesses have got to, I swear on earth, got to tell the truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth and all that stuff. You cannot be protected just because
That's a hell of a story. Talking of hell of a story, changing the subject slightly, I'd love to ask you, from your position in The Guardian, I mean, I've read David Lee's book about Assange and that era.
Yeah. Yeah.
Clearly, we're talking about freedom of information, security state, Assange, hacking, breaking the law. What are the limits of that? I mean, he fell out with The Guardian rather spectacularly, according to that book. You may disagree. But now, of course, he's about to be extradited to a very uncertain fate. And a lot of us are really torn about what to think of this. I'd love to know your perspective.
Well, Julian Assange, who I met a few times early on in there, didn't do much digging on this as David Lee and others in The Guardian, but and he was an awkward customer. You know, he was one of these, you know, is it deeply autistic or whatever? I mean, that's what some people say or allege. He's clearly a man with a mission, whatever you want to call it. He had his source, which is a breach of American security. I mean, that wasn't his fault. If he got in touch with this Chelsea Manning as now a transgender woman, he leaked a tremendous amount of information about American operation in Iraq and Afghanistan, and other diplomatic telegrams were leaked as well. Now, at the beginning, this was okay. Then, in a sense, it's easy to defend because he, for example, revealed how U.S. Helicopter pilots and troops were killing, attacking people who without journalists and other people, with no evidence that these people were terrorists. I mean, you know, let's talk about other more modern, current dispute, violent conflicts now. But anyhow. And so he was, you know, whistleblowing in the traditional, I'd say, best sense of the word. But then he got more and more information leaking more, according to some people, a Pentagon code. Now, I haven't seen the Pentagon code, but that's alleged. And I think maybe he irritated or angered. He created a question of principle for the U.S. or elements of the U.S. government. Now, a couple of things. One is that if you ask former U.S. defense secretaries, Robert Gates and other people, what damage has these leaks done, the Americans would say on and off the record, no, with no evidence of serious damage. People know that people leak. People know that all sides do nasty things in violent conflicts. They cover up and so on and so forth, you know, whether you're the West or the East or the South or North or... So there's an element of that. But then also in America, they changed tack because, well, Obama sort of first he gave Chelsea Manning Assange's main source, pardoned him, now her. And especially Trump's security intelligence people, CIA people, increased the charges against him from leaking and damaging X, Y, and Z to espionage. First journalist being done for ESMA under the American Espionage Act. Very serious stuff. I mean, it could be 125 years sentence, you know. Mm. It's one of those Americans. Hyperbolic sentences, you know.
And you must, do you share my view that whatever Assange has done, that just feels really, really harsh.
Well, has it been? Some people. I mean, that's sort of. You could argue he's been in prison for many years, 7 years, more. He was in the Ecuador embassy. Maybe he shouldn't have done that. He should have coughed about his alleged sexual abuse in Sweden and so on.
Yeah.
But this is years ago too. He's been. I mean, he's in that terrible mental and physical state. Has he been punished enough? The other thing is a question. Just one last, very last point is the extradition treaty between America and the US and the UK, which is actually very unbalanced.
Including
Chris Davis, a Tory and backbencher, is very good on this. Whether it's businessmen done for charged with fraud and so on, or in this case, Julian Assange. Yes,
no, I agree.
Yes, that was the point I was going to make. I mean, we can't extradite a woman who killed.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Killed a former intelligence officer who killed a boy in a car accident, and yet here we are volunteering to give people up.
Exactly. And the local MP there, Andrea what's her name? South Northamptonshire.
She's chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee.
No, another woman, Andrea, who was a minister at one point. Anyway, she was very good at pushing this. The Foreign Office finally were very good at pushing this. So she was tried, or not tried so much as she admitted dangerous driving and manslaughter, or whatever the thing was. But it's sort of suspended sentence. Anyway, she's not coming to Britain. That was quite a good case, which had to be pursued rigorously by the lawyers of the family of this young boy.
For people who don't know, because we're getting very inside. For people who don't know, it was an American intelligence officer based in Britain, drove on the wrong side of the road. You know, it happens. Yeah. Knocked down and killed, and then fled the country. Killed a British schoolboy. Fled the country, refused to come back. We have no rights to grab her. She was, she did, in fact, in the end, take part in a virtual court process. But, you know, when it compared to that, to the way it works the other way, in terms of British justice delivering people to the American system, and it's very one-sided. I've always felt that.
Well, on that point, the question of, you know, Britain kowtowing to, if you like, to Washington, because again, she initially said, or the Americans claimed diplomatic immunity. She was the wife of Croughton, R.E.F. Croughton in South Northamptonshire, is a CIA base. Who knows that? Because I and other journalists have written that and hasn't been denied. Well, it hasn't been admitted either, but you know, it's a big CIA base where they control drone operations in the Middle East and so on.
Last week we discussed Gareth Williams, and I wondered if you had a view on that case.
Well, I'm one of the few people, and I think the police have agree with me, or vice versa, and that I think, given his background, that it was a prank, if you like, gone wrong. He was a very agile person. One or two other people say that could be done. What he did was he locked himself in a bag. He was a very fit, slim person. And some people now say, including some police and not quite forensic scientists, but people who know about these things, say what I've always said. He had a landlady in Cheltenham because he was a seconded from GCHQ to help MI6 in London work out their coding system and computer stuff. MI6, believe it or not, human intelligence, they go with that, not like rely on GCHQ. Everyone relies more and more on GCHQ. That's another question, actually, about talking about surveillance. More and more technical ability to monitor people's activities and so on. Anyway, here's Gareth Williams, who was seconded to GCHQ. And he was missing for a whole week. MI6 management, they're not very good at managing these very old-fashioned outfit, and they're getting a bit marginally better. And, you know, public schoolboy, all that stuff. From MI6, I mean, you know. Unaccountable. They operate abroad, so they don't have to come anywhere near the scrutiny like cops do here, or even MI5 dealing with operation security of Britain inside Britain. So anyway, here's Gareth Williams, and he was found, finally, inside this bag. Now, as I said, just to repeat myself, I said it's a possibility. I've known other people. There's one kind of, Andrew, Phil, you may know this person, James Rusbridger.
Well, James Rusbridger is an author of mine, yes.
He wrote about spooks and intelligence services and so on, and he was a curious man, lived on his own, and he didn't commit suicide intentionally, but he was found dead, having sort of trying a sort of a hanging operation in his cottage in Cornwall. Another person, I remember Milligan, Jonathan Aitken's private secretary.
The orange in the mouth story.
Stephen Milligan, the MP.
Stephen Milligan, that's it. Anyway, going back to Gareth Williams, I think it was possible. But the coroner didn't and thought this unlawful. But no evidence, unlawful. But, you know, they'll think about the CIA, the KGB and so on. But no evidence KGB was involved at all.
What about a fingerprint? There were no fingerprints, for example.
No, exactly. There are no second persons, no alleged killers, no third party evidence that went into his flat, Gareth Williams's flat. By the way, in this inquest, the coroner really put the boot into MI6 for saying, why don't you look after this person better, you know, under your care, for this guy in a sensitive job for a whole week. You didn't inquire, you wouldn't ask his parents where he was, and so on and so forth. Chief of MI6 then, John Sawers, apologized profusely because of rather failings of his staff responsible for the care, if you like, or the, you know, just the question of, you know, he would have been kidnapped by Russians or anything. Not a word of inquiry about one of their own key employees, beg your pardon, for a week in such a sensitive job.
Yeah. Can I raise another sort of campaign that you had, which was the death on the Man of Kintyre in 1994 of a whole series of MI5 and RUC officers in a helicopter crash.
Yes.
And you looked at that because the MOG first of all tried to blame the pilot.
They did.
But you found actually there was another side to this.
Well, two things. One is that the responsibility, if you like, this is sort of in a way a secondary point, that so many senior MI5 and military intelligence people were put on one helicopter. So if that's something wrong with a helicopter for whatever reason, they're all gone. Wealth of experienced people, et cetera, et cetera. But more importantly, these two pilots, well, the pilot and the co-pilot, the Chinook, Special Forces pilot, they were really experienced. And it came about that this particular Chinook helicopter had been involved in certain technical misfunctions, kept quiet, cover up, for some time. And other Chinooks of the same vintage, too, for that matter. And there was a row about, because the top RAF guys who were so embarrassed by the whole thing said, oh, no, the pilot's fault. It was mystery. They shouldn't have gone straight into the hillside and Mull of Kintyre and Scotland, from Northern Ireland they were. One or two people, the RAF people, friends of the pilots, the families of the pilots, kept honoured me, and I said, this is good, give me some more evidence. So I wrote about these increasing questions raised, and had furious arguments with air marshals and so on. Finally, Fox, what's his name, the defence?
Liam Fox,
that's right, who was obviously persuaded, he had some conscience there, or anyway, whatever sparked his serious concern, he ordered an inquiry into this. And you know, some of us, I'm not saying me, but some of us who questioned the whole thing were vindicated, and certainly the pilots were. And there's a big row in the MOD. The MOD is an astonishingly shamelessly never learns lessons. Let's talk about secrecy really again. Uniquely, never learns lessons because they get together, the military side, the civil side, and the political side all together, and their default position is secrecy, secrecy, secrecy. But in the end of the day, the secrecy gets blown apart, or cracks and cracks until it is blown apart more and more. And this Chinook case was a very important case because it involved people's reputations, individual families, two experienced pilots who were killed, as well as the other people, of course, on this flight. Deep embarrassment by the intelligence establishment, inside intelligence establishment, and the RAF. I mean, the vicious correspondence I had with senior RAF air marshals and so on, so, where, of course, most of the papers would say, how can this this Norton Taylor person, the Guardian, sort of raising questions and sort of going down a sort of rabbit hole.
Talking of Northern Ireland, I mean, you've done a lot in Northern Ireland, and you've been writing recently about an agent called Steak Knife. And Steak Knife was an informer who was working for the British, but who was also allowed to carry on various atrocities. And I think you've argued that actually, on the balance, I mean, clearly informers need to be protected, They can't be allowed to. They have to keep on doing the bad things they do. But I think you're now showing that actually, on the whole equation, he did more bad things than good, really.
Well, it's not just me saying it's now that kind of the report came out, or the interim report by the former chief constable and a British chief constable said that they actually. There were more deaths than saving lives as a result of this guy's steak knife activity. Now, steak knife was a key. Well, it's a question of in Northern Ireland in particular, but it happens elsewhere too. That the security intelligence agencies were given a free hand. Steak knife was a agent of the British Army, and of course they talked. MI5 also, the security service knew about him. And the cops too. The cops, of course, defer to, of course, MI5 and Army intelligence. There. Anyway, and this guy Steak Knife was astonishing, really, informer, because he was trusted by the IRA because he was a member of what they called the Nutting Squad. I mean, he was one of the IRA's own internal. Investigative machinery looking out for touts, as it were, informers. But he was giving information to the British Army. The British Army allowed him to continue in his role because that's where his value was, even if it meant, to the British Army's knowledge, killing a lot of IRA alleged touts, alleged informers, which was a very, you know, this is my word, the sickest, but it's the most vicious and amoral, if you like. The morality doesn't really come into these kind of operations. And it's been going on for a long time. Books have been written about Steak Knife. The British Army still do not confirm that Steak Knife was indeed this guy, Scapaducci. That's his family name, which he's now dead. They're still covering up, you know, the British, really. Elements of the British intelligence community, that is to say, the British Army in particular, and because if you let, you know, if you say cough, they admit something there. It's the old thing about, as you know, Andrew, it's the neither confirm nor deny. Even when the evidence piles up, neither confirm nor deny. NCND, because that opens cans of worms. Anyway, this Steak Knife incident or this character. The controversy continues, and it will do until the full final report comes about his activities. The Northern Ireland case, you know, rather like there are lines in that. You know, people have no accountability, and they think they'll get away with it. And it was complete. It was really quite chaotic in Northern Ireland because you had conflicting intelligence agencies on the British side. You had the police, so the MI5. The MI5 took over security command, really, of the whole of Northern Ireland, being part of the UK. MI6, earlier on, MI6 were quite... Sometimes MI6 look ahead. They say, what's going to happen after this, the troubles, if you like, in this case, or after the violence, or after this conflict? And MI6, earlier on, the guy called... talked secretly behind the scenes without ministerial knowledge, although a nod and a wink by some ministers, to talk in the back channels, as they're called, early on with McGuinness and Adams from the IRA years before the Good Friday Agreement. But MI6, the rivalry between MI6, MI5, and the military. Three intelligence agencies, like, and then the police just sort of deferring, because they were the junior agency in all these operations.
I mean, change the subject slightly. I mean, you're not just a journalist, you're a playwright, and the two in some ways are very connected because your plays are very much based on some of the campaigns that you've investigated. I mean, do you feel that plays in some ways can be more effective in bringing subjects to public notice? And we've seen that with the post office scandal recently.
Yeah, I do, actually. I do. I think the theatre, well, the post office scandal, of course, it was television, but I, in the past, have done edited public inquiries mainly. It's not me creating, or it's not my original work. It's editing. But the theatre was a great another platform for journalists, if you like, investigative journalists, because often when you're writing for the newspaper, a running story, you can't get a story in the newspaper or on television or radio every single day. Let's take Bloody Sunday, for example. It went on for 10 years. 10 years evidence, Bloody Sunday, I put in a play of less than 3 hours. And there's an appetite. The point is, an appetite for information. You can't expect people to follow these long cases. The Colour of Justice was a big story, inquiry too, about the racist murder of Stephen Lawrence, the black teenager in South London, many years ago now. That lasts a long time. But if you put these things in a 2.5-3 hours piece, explaining what happened, this is it. The devil's often in the detail. People are speaking themselves. None of these are my words. I mean, I distill them and so on. And an audience with people reacting, a live audience, is actually quite effective and powerful, striking chords, I think. Then, you know, when you're writing, just talking as a journalist now, when you're writing about all this stuff, you never know how many people are reacting or spluttering over their cornflakes or just turning over the page because they're not interested in this thing, especially if they're running. And nor are your editors, actually. They say, oh, my God, Richard, not another story on Bloody Sunday. You know, so you get all this out in a specific piece, on a text, two and a half hours, 3 hours, in a theatre or sometimes the television. I did Nuremberg too, actually, which lasted many, many years too, in about 3 hours. And people there you had Goering, Gottlieb Goering say, what does Speer say? And various things, they didn't want to invade them in Iraq and it's a very rewarding thing, I think, for journalists. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, but you did bring change because Michael Gove, who's a government minister, went to your play on Grenfell. Perhaps you could tell the audience about the Grenfell.
Grenfell, scandal. Andrew.
Grenfell.
Grenfell. Yes, he did. Actually.
Because I think that did make some changes.
Well, it did. Sorry, again, my role here to try to interpret. Yes, this, for people who don't know, are not British, Grenfell, I'm now, you've got me saying it wrong. Grenfell Tower disaster, tragedy, horrible fire at a tower block. People trapped, people dying, people being advised to stay when they should have been told to leave.
Over 70 days.
Terrible, terrible tragedy. And, of course, it turned out that the materials that had been used in this building were, maybe not substandard, but the standards were very low. And people had known that there was very dangerous and fire.
And people knew, enough people shouldn't have, knew that there was inflammable material. Yeah.
And it was in a place that tended to be lived in by poorer people. And maybe that was a factor, and it almost certainly was. And how it was managed.
Well, Michael Gove, who came to a Grenfell play, and to give him his due, am I allowed to say this? I mean, without sounding too sympathetic with any politician, I definitely, he came and listened, and he was genuinely shocked by the irresponsibility, if you like, and the cover-ups by the constructing companies and the people who provided the material. For the knowingly dangerous material for this tower block reconstruction, if you like. And he was genuinely shocked. And I think that encouraged him to, he hadn't succeeded yet entirely because in effect this material was used in many other tower blocks and affecting leaseholders now. Leaseholders can't sell their properties and all that.
And have people got compensation? I mean, have the rules changed about cladding, for example?
Well, they try to change the rules, and then there's an offer of compensation, but they haven't got them yet. It's like compensation on lots of other things. You mentioned the post office scandal before. But going back to Gove did actually take it on board, I think. And he didn't. Civil servants don't give him the evidence and stuff, because partly the evidence shows that Whitehall civil servants were lazy.
Yes.
Pass the buck. Passing the buck is another wonderful thing in Whitehall. You know,
it's great that you could condense it all into a single emotional experience.
Well, I think
get the attention of people that mattered.
Yeah.
That
years of being a journalist, and you get this word, it's the craft of trade. What is journalism? That's what people question. But you get the craft of distilling things. You edit yourself. when you're listening, when you're on a court room or whatever it is, you're writing down in your notebook lots of material, many words. You've got to, when you're writing a story, you've got to actually say to yourself, you know, condense it into 900 words. 900 words, 800 words, 500 words, that's not very much. And sometimes you're lucky, you get a sort of a feature, you get a whole page, 1,000 words, 1,200 words. But, you know, these plays, many more thousands of words.
Anybody who's written a book, and I think all three of us have, exactly, will tell you that the problem isn't writing, the problem is editing.
Yeah, well, in a way, yeah, absolutely. But that's why it's so relieving. I mean, Andrew, you would know that writing a book is more satisfying sometimes. It's a hell of a sweat, of course, but that's my answer. The playwriting was also rewarding, and people commented, and people came. People don't go to the theatre came. Anyway, yeah.
And looking back over 50 years, what have been the most rewarding moments of the things that you did? And do you feel things are changing?
Well, I think things, yes.
There's less accountability or more?
Well, I think rewarding in the sense of, you know, not so much that you've been proved right on so many things, like, let's say, going back to your invasion of Iraq, secrecy in the MOD, and you're proved right, whether it's even weapon systems that don't work, still don't work, waste of money, or whether the Chinook case we talked about, and the Chinook crash and the causes of that crash in the Mull of Kantar, the general awareness that they should open up this most secretive part of government or state activity done in our name, if you're paid by taxpayers, i.e. the activities of the security intelligence agencies. I think the links with the CIA on sending people to Guantanamo Bay, British citizens or British residents, denied for years and years by ministers. And so it's basically opening up things. And eventually they say, look, we cannot keep this quiet because there'll be certain journalists who will pursue this, who will be persistent, and maybe not many of us, but quite a few of us. But this is on I just want to say something about the general point about surveillance. Can I say something about that? Or
of course you can.
Yes, absolutely. Just do.
Between Britain and the British intelligence security companies, agencies, sorry, and the public and the police for that matter. And that is that there are more and more, the growth of intrusive technology, like surveillance technology, computer technology, is so great that, and the intelligence security agencies cannot resist amassing all this, because they can amass it, as Edward Snowden, this former American National Security Agency contractor, revealed not a few years ago. And when GCHQ, for example, had all these enormous computers doing some good work, we want to know if Britain is under threat, you know, and especially under another cyber attack by the Russians or whoever. But they've got to see what is relevant. They can't be flooded by all this material. And they say, you know, oh, it's difficult to find all these real threats, the terrorists, you know, difficult to find the needles in the haystacks. Well, I say they're building more and more haystacks by amassing more and more material, which they cannot possibly have the serious, effective investigating the significance of this material. Most of the serious terrorist attacks in Britain, quite a few in the 2017, Manchester Arena, Westminster Bridge, London Borough Market, 7/7 London bombings. They were the people, the suicide bombers, the bombers, the perpetrators were known to MI5 and the intelligence services. Now the MI5 can't do anything, but you've got to have basic old-fashioned resources, old-fashioned police work, if you like, on the ground, not relying on the easy reliance on red signals coming out, danger signs coming out on your computers. You know, that doesn't work anymore. Anyway, that's one of my big points about
the future. No, I agree. It's an interesting one. The wood for the trees.
We should look into that, Andrew. Before we let you go, Richard, I thought you'd like to know that you have a review for your book, The State of Secrecy, A young man called Andrew Loney was quite impressed.
He knows it. I'm sure he knows about it.
He's quite impressed. And he says, and I think he's absolutely right to say, we are very lucky as a nation to have independent journalists like Norton Taylor who are prepared to speak truth to power. And I recommend the book, Universal.
That's very, very kind, Andrew. Well, Andrew, if I may say so, is a very, very, well, it started off, I knew him when he was more of a kind of literary agent than actually a writer. An author of very good books, including that one, well, all sorts of ones which I may anyway.
Well, you're a great inspiration to me, and I mean, I wish there were more journalists like you what you do.
But it's quite interesting because I mean, I'm getting old. I'm getting on for 80 now, but actually, it keeps your brain going because if your health is okay, and you've got the kind of urge to pursue and attack secrecy when you to reveal things. Now, reveal things is maybe too pompous a word, but to investigate. That's what I call the powers of the forces of darkness. I mean, the forces of darkness, even in Britain, a democracy, but they are there, and Andrew, you well know. And, you know, and official secrecy and the troubles you've had, I've had about breaking down and the expense, actually, too, in your case, of breaking down official secrecy, which the other thing is frustrating because it actually, at the end of the day, things are going to open up. It may take a very, very long time. That's the frustrating thing. But it's putting on the, if you like, the forces of darkness, those people who are so secretive, on the defensive, and making them worried.
Our argument is that the secrets they protect are often very innocent, and that means that it just leaves a vacuum for speculation. We see it with royal coverage as well. Exactly. And it's better. I mean, we would earn more trust if we could trust them to be secret about the really important things. But I like that idea that we need to raise our blood pressure just to, as we get older, just to keep ourselves young.
Keep the brain going. The brain is a muscle, as you keep on saying. Even neuroscientists say they agree with that now. The brain
May you exercise yours in the public interest, as you have so many times. And thank you so much.
We'd love to have you back.
Experience with us. Really inspiring.
Excellent. Well, a lot of ground covered there.
Yeah, we're so lucky to get to talk to people like Richard. I mean, and lots of other of our old friends who do important work. It really is. It's a nice part of what we do, I think.
Yes, and I think what they do is do it with great dignity and perseverance, but it's not the sort of angry sort of agitation that you get from some writers. I mean, I think he does get cross, as I do, about some of the terrible things that go on. But I think, you know, because he appears always so level-headed
I think he enjoys it. It's a game, isn't it? A game of kind of tracking people down and bursting pompous balloons and things like that.
I wonder if it all goes back to our childhood and being, you know, some are natural rebels or anti-authoritarian and others are a natural sort of head prefects.
Yes. I think that's
where would you be?
I'd probably be more the prefect end of the scale when I was a kid, I have to say. I suspect you were, even though your famously posh background, I reckon you were always a troublemaker, a member of the awkward squad.
I was just a quiet rebel, yes. Gosh, so you've moved. You've got less, because, I mean, you moved from becoming a Republican to supporting the monarchy. So in some ways...
A little bit, yeah. In terms of the monarchy, I probably have changed my position. But I spent a long time working on these campaigning shows like World in Action and Panorama and, you know, played a small part in some pretty exciting stories that did all the things that Richard just talked about.
Exactly. Well, I think we should perhaps do a program on your TV career because there are a lot of awards, a lot of programs.
Who knows?
And a lot of things that you got changed. And I think people aren't aware of that. So maybe that's what we should have coming up.
Right. Well, when we run out of Guardian reporters to interview, we can start talking to ourselves again. But I thought that was really interesting. I really like Richard a lot.
Yes, yes, yes. No, he's. You know, I hope we can get him back, talk about Lockerbie and other things.
No, let's do that. So, actually, talking of impressive people, I should have mentioned at the beginning of the show, we had loads of people just being so warm and positive about Jason Evans, who talked to us last week, well, 4 days ago, about the infected blood scandal. Just so many lovely comments about his dignity. And, you know, a few sentimental things too, which is Lynn Hubbard, who's an old friend of ours, simply said, if there's an afterlife, Jason's late father will be applauding him and so proud. And I thought that was rather moving.
Which is nice.
For those who don't know, Jason lost his dad when he was very young to this scandal and has spent the better part of his life trying to get to the bottom of it and get some justice and some changes.
Yeah. Well, it's nice when, you know, the serious programs that we do like that do get, you know, a lot of feedback and traction, because that's, I think, really what we like doing.
Yes.
Shining a light on some of these stories.
We do. We do. All right. Well, talking of which, we've got some more treats coming up. We're still sticking to two a week for a while. We've got a snooker film. We're talking about Hess, a snooker film, no longer in television, Phil, a snooker program. We're going to talk about Rudolf Hess. Hannah Barnes is joining us soon to talk about the Tavistock. We talked about European royalty, but I think you found a way to make a program just on the Spanish royal family. Is that right?
I'm hoping so. I think King Juan has got quite a checkered history. And so I'm looking for a journalist or a writer who can talk knowledgeably about the subject in English. So hopefully we'll get something there. I mean, there are clearly a lot of European royals we could be talking about. Someone has suggested a number of subjects. So I think we may be looking at that. So we're trying to mix the contemporary with the historical.
We are. I mentioned my wife, who runs Putney Library, a few times. She's a book that she loves about the great women of ancient Rome and their life stories. We're going to be doing a program on that. Scandals of the ancient world. And some of them are pretty hair-raising.
Yes, I'm looking forward to reading it, that book too. So, a very varied program coming up, and we hope you like it.
We certainly do. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you both soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.